Good evening, everyone. Happy quarantine. Hello, everyone. This week, I'm very excited to have this guest on Get the Fork Out. She grows microherbs, I have to say, with an H, not the silent one from the American.
Sorry,
herbs. Heidi's Herbs. She lives and grows in Palma de Mallorca, and she has these amazing edible leaves and flowers. So not just tiny flowers that look good, but flowers of plants that we eat. Hi, Heidi. Welcome to Get the Fork Out.
Hi, Brennan. Nice to meet you.
Just
a little correction. I don't do micro herbs at all. Okay. I only do actual edible flowers and leaves, just because my ethos is against using a lot of plastics and pesticides, and micro herbs uses a lot of that kind of stuff. So I don't grow micro herbs for that reason.
That's great. So tell us like a little bit more about that differentiation between the definition of microherbs and then, you know, leaves and flowers.
Microherbs is growing a plant from the seed for a very short time. So you get, I mean, it's a great product. Any chef loves microherbs and you get a lot of nutrition from them, but they're very high intensity growing, very, very much, it's very intensive, very localized, very high in plastics, very high in pesticides and fertilizers. Whereas my business focuses more on edible flowers and edible leaves. And my ethos is to go from the seed through the whole cycle of the plant to the point of collecting my own seeds again and regrowing from my own seeds. So mine is a sustainable loop of agriculture as opposed to microgreens, which is not sustainable and it's very intensive and you don't ever regrow from that plant because you're cutting at a too young a stage to regenerate it. So
Fascinating. I'm very excited just for that snippet right there. It was perfect because I don't think a lot of us have thought of that. And I'd be interested to come and see your farm as well and taste these things and see the full cycle of life, because I think it's really special what you're doing. It's different.
Well, I've been interested in it for quite a while now. I started about 7 years ago now, having worked as a yacht chef for many years back in the 90s and in the 80s even. I started sailing then already. And I had the luck to go far afield all over the world with the yachts. And the people that I worked for were in the hotel industry and in the food industry. So they were really, really interested in what they were putting in their stomachs and their mouths back then already. And everything then already was organic on the boat that I worked on. So I got a lot of knowledge from working for people like that. So a little bit before the whole organic drive already. So it was very interesting to me. And then from a personal point of view, my mom had cancer when I was young as a kid. And she died at a very young age, but she was very interested in where her cancer had come from. And she was convinced that it was due to her growing up in Zimbabwe and being exposed to DDT and all these kinds of chemicals.
Yeah.
So obviously when I left yachting, this was foremost in my mind. And I have had three small kids. I wanted to start a business. And I was very concerned about what my kids were going to eat and where the food was coming from. So this is what inspired my business.
That's incredible. What an amazing story. I'm sorry for your mother, and I'm sorry that anyone has to be exposed to those chemicals in this day and age. You know, that's pretty
hard. I think very few people realize all the processes that go into growing good food.
Yeah.
And all the processes that are involved in the food that we're buying from a supermarket. So most of the food that we pick up from a normal supermarket has traveled thousands of kilometers before it even gets to the shelf.
Right.
And the value of nutrition in the food that we're buying from a local a grower is so much higher than something that's come from Chile or Argentina or avocados from Ecuador or apples from South Africa. they just don't have the same nutritional value.
Why do you think that is? Is it just kind of just lost its life force? It was picked so early and it just hasn't had the sun and the nitrates and everything
absolutely
absorbed into it.
Absolutely. So the sooner you pick the fruit, number one, it's not being ripened on the tree. It's ripening as it travels. I think the rule of thumb is almost that you're losing 90% of the nutritional value of a product once you've picked it within the first 24 hours.
That's incredible. And awful at the same time. That's brutal. That's a brutal stat. Now, and you're the second person I've had in a row in farming. And I think because I'm missing that part of being a chef so let's say a land chef. Like you have these connections to the farm and your local area and what you can grab and seasonality. And the yachting, you don't really have that. So I think that's what I'm grasping at for. And I'm hoping like other people want to hear these things too, because it's very hard for us to kind of know what we're buying. Even though we get it from very good sources and we pay top dollar for it, we still don't know exactly where it came from, what country. It just knows, like, it ticks a box on our provisioning list, and we have peas. Maybe they're from Peru. I don't know. They look beautiful. They taste nice. But that's the connection that I think I'm trying to make, too, is how to figure out different spots in the world where yacht chefs can get some really cool stuff and just have this like the amazing produce at hand.
I think there's been this whole disconnect since the Industrial Revolution and when agriculture was then industrialized in the 60s and 70s, you saw supermarkets opening up a bountiful amount of fruit and veg on the shelves because these things were easily produced in mass quantities. And that's where you started losing smaller plants and things that you would normally have eaten before then that was grown in the local garden at home, that you were growing your own peas or things. So, I mean, even fresh peas is something that I'm sure you as a chef have found really difficult to source.
Yeah, and they're so special. They taste, I mean, how can you compare them to anything else? They like taste like green sunshine. They're so tasty.
Exactly.
Sweet. They're almost like a fruit. Amazing.
Oh, no, they're absolutely delicious. And my kids, I mean, I have to fight them to get any product to the market because they eat everything before it even hits the market store.
And they're kind of fun to eat too, yeah. But something I wanted to touch on that reminded me of it too, because it remembers, it's kind of like a little bit older in terms of, I guess it's the same time, the 60s and 70s, but canned foods became like a luxury because that was new technology. And it was just
exactly.
Like, and it was kind of like, you know, my grandmother's or maybe her grandmother's or her mother's time where that's how they knew how to cook, just crush it out of a can. And that was luxury because it was new. And I think sliced bread, you know, Wonder Bread, all that kind of shit food came in the same area where we, as humans, we were experimenting on what processed foods could be. And I don't like the word processed. I don't think it's succinct enough. It's just kind of, if I cut a carrot, I process it. So I wish there was a more clear line, but you know what I mean. You know what I mean?
Well, I know what you mean, because I mean, the whole thing about getting the food to the table from the grower, there's this huge distinction, I think, that needs to be made now about the nutritional value of what you're eating. And there's so much information now coming out with the whole gut-brain biome and how important it is to eat things that will support your gut microbiotics. I have a son who has some food issues, so it's a great passion of mine learning about all of this. So, I mean, back in the days of our great-grandparents, they were eating so much more variety in their diet, as opposed to most families nowadays. You're lucky if you're eating 15 different kinds of fruits and vegetables in your diet.
Yeah.
And there's something like 130 different edible plants out there that you could be eating, but we're only eating 10 to 15 if we're lucky, you know?
Because of convenience. And maybe lack of education too, because I think some people are afraid to try new things. They're afraid to spend the money on something they don't know and kind of get hung up.
But this is another thing that I find really interesting, is because eating flowers is not new. If you go back to the Victorian times and the Greek times and all of those times, They used to have lavender in their diet. They used to eat rose petals all the time. Flowers were always an edible thing that people ate. It's just that it's not something that transports well.
Right.
So it's everyone
it's
says,
viable.
Oh, it's this new fad, but it's not really
it
at
just
the
hasn't
end of
been
the day.
Profitable. Not yet.
No, it hasn't been profitable because it's not easy to send it for long distances. And it's not easy to refrigerate and send it because the product at the end of the day won't appear on the market shelves in the kind of pristine, you know, this the perfect apple, the perfect orange
right.
syndrome that we have in today's food.
Right.
It won't travel well.
Yeah, it can't travel well, and it can't travel that space of time as well. Like, it just won't last that long. It's but
exactly.
As you're saying that, I'm thinking too, it's like we almost need to be, and this isn't a new concept, but we almost need to become decentralized in terms of like getting away from factories that kind of pump things into supermarkets and go back to farm to table. But it's quite difficult. And my perspective is so tweaked because I'm a yacht chef and I've been a yacht chef for a long time. So farm to table for me is impossible. And I miss the community. I miss the idea of a community that I never had of like farmers and chefs all together doing the same thing, pointing in the same direction for sustainability and health and having conversations about gut mind health. I think they're important.
Yeah, I have seen this year in particular that there are a lot more yacht chefs out there that are trying to buy more local, which is amazing for local small growers because we lose so much money by going through the bigger channels. I mean,
of course,
even in my case, I mean, the people that I sell to will then double the price and make most of the profit by doing not even a fraction amount of work
right.
that gets put into making that product.
The,
you know,
the middleman makes all
the
money.
All they have to do is collect the boxes and sell it on because someone ticked the box.
Yeah.
They don't do any of the growing, the watering, the planting, the dealing with the pests. You know, it's quite interesting how little the grower at the beginning of the cycle will get for the product that is sold at the end, you know?
And I think that's globally.
And I think this is something that really needs to change. Yeah.
Agreed.
But I think the yacht chefs are really starting to notice the difference in that, you know?
Well, I think it's important. It's just better on every front, but also it's a story you can tell the guests. The guests are going to appreciate it. Most guests, I'd say. Yeah. It depends on who you have on board. What you know, owner versus charter. But I would say most guests should care. And it's a great story. It's like, yeah, there's a local woman here in Palma. I know it's a little bit, we'll make one extra stop. I'm going to go to shore, get about 5 boxes of some nice stuff and we'll do lunch. It's just, it's difficult. It's a little bit trickier for the yacht chef too, because it's more work than just bang, just order it from a provisioner, you know?
That's exactly. I mean, if I'm looking at what my lifestyle was on a yacht back in the late 80s, early 90s, I've really noticed a disconnect from buying produce from the yacht chefs. I mean, I used to always go to the local markets and buy, but I think as the industry has grown so much in the last 25 to 35 years, yacht chefs don't have the time to get off the boat. They send it out to a provisioner, and the provisioner is that lies with the provisioner to get the best product for the yacht chef. And that's where you're losing a little bit of the connection for getting the best produce. Yeah.
And not knocking provisioners, but then they become the middleman.
No, absolutely
markup.
Not.
No, yeah.
Yeah.
And there's
no,
that markup.
I mean,
because
provisioners
like coffee
are needed.
And whoever grows it seems to make the least amount of money. Like the most important person in the cycle of a life of a, let's just say a pea, makes the least amount of money globally. It's always the middleman that makes the most. And then maybe the chefs, as they repurpose it and tweak it into their own way, and then we make money on it as well. But I think that's all commodities. I don't know. That's a bigger conversation about the people that do most of the work getting less money.
A whole other can of worms.
Yeah.
I do think that in the next 10 to 15 years, you are going to see a big change in that. I think as our health systems become more and more they can't take the stress of all the illnesses that I feel are directly related to the stress of what we are putting our agricultural system through. I mean, I believe that the root of all good produce is the soil that you're using, number one. And there was an amazing documentary made just not that long ago called Kiss the Ground. I don't know if you've watched that at all.
No.
And it's all about the fact that they say there's only 60 years left of arable soil.
Yeah, I've heard that stat, you know, before, quite recently, actually.
And that's crazy. I mean, if you look at our farming practices, we have to support local growers. We have to support people who are doing no-till farming. We have to support people who are supporting microcultures for bees. It's all interlinked. Yeah, it's all interlinked. And it's really, really important that people start looking into that more.
Well, and I completely agree with you. But I also, I don't know why, but I had this like realistic part of my mind where, well, it's not realistic, maybe it's a bit negative, where the motivation has to be in the right place for humans, unfortunately. And so we're either motivated by money or death at this point, or money or fear.
Yeah.
Good, of course, you know, motivated by love, yes, but it's much farther down the list, unfortunately. So unless things get a little bit more dire, and I hope they don't have to, I hope I'm wrong. I want to be wrong on this. I'm just trying to be like, well, everything's about money right now. We're not too worried about getting killed by our food yet, unless we get really good science that be like, look, you can't eat this way. It's just not possible. You'll get something bad will happen to your gut biome and you'll die in a bad way. And I'm hoping you're right. In the future, we just find this way where we know how our bodies actually work. It's no more guesswork. It's no more like, oh, a different fat diet every 30 days. And this is the key. It's like, no, this is the human biome project, I think it's called. Yeah, there's a human genome project and there's a human biome project. And I think that's really interesting. And that's the real key to like individualized healthcare. Like your gut biome is so different than mine. Why would you give me the two of us the same treatment? So it's
exactly. I mean, anyone who's interested in the whole biome thing, there's a really great book written by, his name's Bill Bozovich. It's called Fiber Fueled. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. It's a really good book about how important fiber is in our diet and how important it is to eat more fruit and vegetables, etc., instead of always an acidic meat-based diet. I mean, I love my meat. I'm South African. But I do definitely realize that even I don't eat enough fruit and vegetable, and I have to focus more on that to keep myself more healthy, you know.
Well, I'm the same. I'm at a hotel and I ate at the buffet and I had eggs. I had sliced meat, sliced cheese, like a croissant. And I went right past the fruit. Well, the veggies look horrible, but I went right past the fruit. I struggle with the same. I gravitate towards those things. But I think I want to put in the comments the two books that you've mentioned, or the documentary and the book that you've mentioned, so that people can read up on this. And I'll do the same. It's fascinating stuff. I think it's so cool, and I feel like it's an exciting time in humanity where we might see some actual change in our lifetime. I hope.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And then the other thing that a lot of people don't realize about edible flowers, and I have lectured at certain cooking classes and things that have happened here in Palma with the Galley Gang, on the flavor profiles of flowers, because flowers aren't just on the plate to look pretty. They're there to add to the palate of what you're cooking. So you have savory flowers, you have sweet flowers, you have flowers that taste like cinnamon. I mean, there's so many flavor profiles out there for the flowers. So experiment when you buy a box of flowers, taste them. Taste as to what you can add them to in your food, because they're another element to eat, you know? Yeah. And just use a petal. More doesn't mean better. Sometimes just a petal here or there makes all the difference to the flavor profile of what you're presenting.
Yeah, I find them really tasty and obviously beautiful. And I do think they're becoming more and more prolific in higher end food. And it's fun to watch, because I remember when I was a young chef, I've been cooking food for a while, so like almost 30 years. And like in the beginning, it was like marigolds and orchids. You know, that was kind of it. That's all you could find. That would come on platters and whatnot. And it was kind of a thing for a bit, and then it went away. Same with like prickly pear juice and all that. It's all coming back. But now the flowers now are incredible. Things I never would have thought about that. Of course, why wouldn't we want this? Why wouldn't we want the flower version of this amazing vegetable or fruit? That's amazing.
And also, one of the things that I'm growing now, which is amazing for me, is purslane. I don't know if you know about golden purslane at all. I mean, that's an old plant that people used to always use and put in their potato salads and stuff. And it's one of the highest omega-3 plants out there. It's higher than salmon, you know? Really? So there's so much stuff out there. I try and research and grow a new plant every year if I can to add to what I can offer to a chef, because it's just so interesting.
Yeah, it is.
And I mean, most of our medicines come from flowers and plants. So medically wise, you can get so much from these plants that are growing in your backyard and sometimes are a weed that you're just pulling out anyway, you know?
It doesn't have to come in a dumb little white pill. It just comes.
No, it doesn't have to come in a dumb little white pill. Yeah.
I was actually watching, have you seen Fantastic Fungi? I was watching it last night with my friend. And I encourage you to do that. It's really cool. It's exactly what we're talking about in terms of using what's natural, what's around us, and what the elder, more connected versions of ourself used to use as we metamorphosis from apes into what we are now. And then a disconnect, exactly what we're talking about now, where we just went down this road of technology and forgot all the naturalist stuff that we really formed and shaped who we are now. And we're just like, no, we can't do it. So it is about psilocybin, but there's, I don't know, it's about 10% about that. But the rest is about like turkey tail and lion's mane and all these mushrooms that are becoming quite famous for these scientifically studied practical uses for helping people not be as ill. It's good.
Exactly. I mean, mushrooms for Alzheimer's is just one of the best kinds of things that you can eat, you know?
Yeah. Neurogenesis.
Yeah. Exactly. And I mean, this, I think, while people are researching more and finding out more about our different kinds of food sources, it's just so interesting. I mean, there isn't a day that goes by that I don't learn something new. And I realize how little I actually know.
how little we all know. You know, like, exactly. I think it's still a mystery. We're still, this is something I've been playing around with. I haven't got the wording right, but I always think of, like, you know how we kind of make fun of the past, like 100 years ago, or 1,000 years ago, they were bleeding people with leeches and so stupid, so primitive. But the time we're in
now. And
the
world was flat.
Say it again.
And the world was flat.
Exactly. But like, they're still going to look back in time at us and clearly make fun of the dumb things that we're doing. But because we exist, our small window of life is in the huge timeline of humanity and even a bigger one of the planet and universe. But like, we're just here for a blip and we just assume this is like the apex and it'll never get better. It's like, no, it's going to skyrocket past this or down, who knows? But it's just, I don't know. I haven't worded that well, but it's just something I think about. In your lifespan, you just assume this is it. This is the greatest. It's like, it's going to continue getting better. We're going to continue to learn more.
Yeah, I mean, I just, my kids have just finished their A-levels and I keep saying to them, do you know how lucky you are to be able to just switch on the internet and research anything you want? Yeah. So I had to go to the local library.
So did I.
And book the book for 2 weeks from now to actually get it out for a week of reading, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I remember those days as well. It was quite primitive. I remember the second level, the median was, remember microfiche? Where they compile like every periodical known to man and they put it on those thin slides and you looked in this weird kind of viewer and you could
Yes. Yeah.
That was almost internet.
Almost internet, but not quite.
Not quite at all. No, still annoying, still a pain in the ass. Well, I mean, so these are fascinating conversations, but I mean, I feel like I want to talk about your business too and get yacht chefs to come use you while they're in Mallorca or while they're in Barcelona and connect with, and also what I've noticed too is connecting with provisioners is really cool too, because then you can still give the product to the yacht chef and then still have that connection and the story to give to the guests. But look, there's this beautiful farm in Mallorca, and they've grown this, and this. Try this, you know, try this with a honey or whatever. So how long have you been growing? Where do you?
I've been growing since it's about 7 or 8 years now that I've been growing. Because when we had our children, we decided to build a house out in the countryside. So we built a house. And then when we were busy doing that, we dug our own well. And I'd been advised by someone, when you dig the well, take the soil that you're digging up from the well and spread it on the land because it's so high in nutrition for plants.
Clever.
So I followed that. And then I did quite a lot of research on how to run a small farm. So one of the really good books that I used for that, there's a book called Self-Sufficiency by John Seymour, which is quite an old book, but wow, he's got so much relevant information in there. And then I also really got inspired by a guy who wrote the book The Market Gardener. He's a farmer up in Canada. His name is Jean-Martin Fortier. And he grows totally organically. He doesn't spray anything. And he has a thriving business. And he uses old school farming technologies. He's reinvented some of the old farm tools that they used to use. Him and his wife had traveled all around and had looked at how people grow in dry climates. Like in Mexico, they use urns which they bury in the ground, and then they fill the water into these urns buried in the ground and then water the crops through seepage. So all these kinds of things are really relevant to where you're growing, what your microclimate is like. And of course I've got this I majored in environmental geography back at university when I was in college, which was in the 80s, and I'm interested in how the world's weather is changing. And I definitely have noticed when I was traveling on boats how things were being impacted on this beautiful islands we used to go to. Like we went to the Seychelles once for a year, and how the farmers and the fishermen were all complaining about how all the fish were dying out because the coral reefs were drying out. And you definitely see how the climate goes in cycles. And I think it's really, really relevant to farming in localized areas. Even my friend down the road from me has a different microclimate to me. So I'll have a flower that's growing the same as her, and mine will flower 3 to 4 weeks before hers even shows a bud.
Wow.
So it's very interesting how microclimate affects everything that you do, and how your soil affects it, how you treat it affects it.
Well, so, how fragile it is. I mean, and how
it's very fragile
by the environment.
Yeah, very, very fragile.
But I wanted to make a comment too on, you mentioned the I think it was the Canadian guy, and I love to hear that he's doing well. Like the profitability has to be profitable. Like it needs to be.
And we need to pay more for it. I think he makes 10,000. I think he wrote another book, please don't quote me on this, and I know it's probably not exactly right, but he called it the $10,000 a month market gardener. So he was making a really good living, and he has a fantastic YouTube channel as well about how he grows and what he does. So I definitely would recommend that.
Yeah, I'll definitely check it. I want to kind of, maybe after we finish, I'll write all this. Well, I went like this, but I'll type it, type all this stuff down so I can have it in the comments in that way, or have it in the description so people can find all this stuff. Cause like,
no, I think
it's as a yacht chef, I'm like, in my mind, I'm thinking, oh God, I'm so far away from having a garden. I want one. I had one growing up, but it's like, I'm still a yacht chef. Like. Maybe one day when I grow up, I'll garden and I'll read all these books. I'm looking forward to it.
I mean, I had a yacht just the other day say to me, can you bring me some pots and some seeds? Because we're trying to do a little garden on the boat. And I mean, I was lucky enough to, when I was working on the boats, the people we worked for, that we built the yacht ourselves. And I actually built a little garden on the yacht, a little garden window box.
Where'd you put it? In the galley window?
No, it was much bigger. It was actually one of the features in the main saloon of the boat.
So I
built in this whole box with with drainage and the whole lot. I had my own bay leaf tree in there. I had my herbs. Everything was in there. So I traveled with that wherever I went.
That's awesome.
It was great, you know? Yeah.
That's really
cool.
And
that was more than 30 years ago. So I think slowly people are going back to that way of doing things. And I mean, there's some amazing equipment out there now where you can buy these fridges. It's not a fridge, but it's a growing cabinet that you can install on a big boat, that where you can grow your own micro herbs and plants if you wanted to. There's an amazing stuff out there at the moment.
Well, the person I had on before you, that show aired last week, was vertical farming. And it's very, and it seems, as far as sustainability, I've done no research, but it just seems fascinating how it uses a lot less water. All the roots are exposed. You know, it's the opposite of where this stuff came from. And it's really expensive now, but it just sounded like an idea of the future. Like it really isn't my place to say yes or no, that's sustainable. I don't know the research whatsoever. I'll cop to that. I know food, but it was really cool. And I don't know how, I don't know what the world looks like if climate change keeps going at this speed, and those little containers or something like that, I'd like them to be built into the boat. That would be the ultimate to have.
I think all your chefs would go that way if they could. So much work to keep it up and going, because it does. Let's be honest, farming takes a lot of hard work, a lot of long hours, and it's every day. You have to check that the moisture is right, that the plants are deadheaded if you wanted to redo things. And plants have a cycle. So I think that also brings in the whole question of seasonality of what you're eating.
That's a big one.
That's a whole other story
Yeah, because you'll have I'm exaggerating. This never happened, but you could see it. You could be like a charter guest, be like, it's February. They're in St. Barts. Like, wow, why does tomato taste like shit? Well, it's February. You're in the Northern Hemisphere. It's supposed to taste like shit. You're lucky you have one, really. You know, and that's the reality that we've
been
so detached from. It's just like, no, tomatoes are supposed to taste like August in Italy year round, and it's not fair.
Exactly. I know. And I think there again, it's what is easy to grow and what isn't easy to grow, you know? So tomatoes, onions and peppers in the Mediterranean, you can't beat them anywhere else.
No.
But apples from Canada taste amazing, you know? They're not as good here. So
Spain has some good stuff too, though.
Yeah. But a lot of what's being grown in Spain now is not being grown naturally. It is all greenhouses. And I don't have a greenhouse. I only grow outside with sun and water and manual labor. I don't use anything else. I use worm tea from my wormery, and I use banana peels to make banana tea, and I don't add anything else. And if I have bugs or pests, I pick them off by hand.
But explain what worm tea and banana leaf tea is, or banana peel.
Okay, so when you have a banana, instead of throwing the skin away, you put it in a bucket and you let it soak in the bucket in water for maybe a week. And it creates like a tea out of the skins. And bananas are incredibly high in potassium and nitrogen, which is one of the best things for feeding plants.
Does it start to ferment at all? Does it kick over?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely it does.
That's awesome. And like that goes back into the gut biome sort of thing, and how we used to eat constantly.
Yeah.
To not get sick.
And then worm tea is, I do all my own compost. So I don't throw any organic stuff away at my house. I have dogs, cats, chickens, lambs, and the compost bin.
Yeah.
Not to mention the three other animals, which are my children. So everything that I can reuse, I reuse. So, of course, chickens will eat absolutely anything and everything. And their poo is one of the best nitrogens that you can add to your plants, but you can't add it directly because it will burn the roots of the plants. And then, of course, everyone knows about horse manure and cow manure.
Yeah.
But any kind of manure you need to let mature before you can add it into your soil. So these are all old skills that people used to know, like leaf mulch and all of that kind of thing. Letting everything rot down, create its own little factory because it heats up and it creates perfect soil. And then, of course, the worms also will eat away. I think there's some amazing new bins that have come out in the last few years that you can actually put all your organic produce into, which will have an organic system inside it, which will produce soil, which you could have on a boat, you know? So there's a lot of really interesting stuff out there that could be adapted to galleys nowadays.
Well, definitely. I don't know, we're just meeting now for the first time, but keeping a loop, anything you see that's cool, that's kind of could be practical on a yacht, because we do.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, I'll definitely send that to you.
I'll send a picture when I get back on the yacht. I'll have the other chef, the other head chef, Dean, he's awesome too. Have him send a video of that. We do have kind of window, it could fit a window box quite easily, but I'm not sure how fast we can grow stuff and how long it would last, but right now I have some money trees I found in Whole Foods. I don't know what they are. I was like, oh, money trees. So we put some nice, at least it's green and trees like living in the galley.
Yeah.
I love greenery.
Yeah, yeah.
And growing and feels nice.
Well, anything green is adding to your oxygen levels in your living environment.
Yeah.
It takes all your carbon dioxide and produces oxygen from it, you know?
Yeah.
It's good for you.
Yeah.
Even if you can't eat it.
It's the same as like the old school way of garnishing plates, you know, like you put like a piece of kale or parsley in a lemon wedge, you know, it's like we need to see that green. Maybe we know the connection to our, you know, to our oxygen needs. Like we need this green stuff.
Yeah.
It's important.
I think Noma was the first restaurant, really. I mean, when they first became one of the top restaurants in the world, they really presented this whole notion of a garden on the plate, you know, and that certainly comes through more and more. And I mean, I'm a great fan of MasterChef Australia purely because they have this amazing garden outside that people go out and use, you know.
That's
such an amazing thing to see, because it connects you more to the flavors and things that herbs bring to your your plate, you know?
Yeah. And you would see the chefs that would be excited about that, and the other ones that are just used to reaching into a fridge like myself. I think I would be excited about it too, but it's like, I'm just so disconnected from a garden being a yacht chef. I can't reiterate that enough. Maybe that's why that I just thought it'd be really cool to have you on.
Thanks.
All the things that I'm missing, you know, like what are your kind of favorite or most popular items that are things that you love to eat and love to tell people about?
I think for me, the flower that really got me interested in growing edible flowers was borage.
Uh-huh.
So the little blue star-like flower.
Yeah, they're tiny.
That is the only natural form of cortisone on the planet.
Really?
Of plants. So cortisone, relating back to my mom, is what they treat you with if you have cancer or multiple sclerosis or any of these diseases. And I've got quite a bit of German heritage in my blood as well. So the Germans and the Dutch do a lot of teas. So borage tea was something that I researched for my mom so that she got a natural form of borage rather than a medical form of borage, just to help her and support her. But I mean, borage has got this amazing cucumber flavor and is a great accompaniment to any dish that you do, whether it's a dessert or a savory plate or a salad, and it's so bright and vibrant.
Yeah.
And then I think for what the customers like, a lot of people really like nasturtium.
Oh, yeah, that's super popular now. How long does borage last once you pick it?
Okay, so borage really here in Spain is a springtime flower because it needs a lot of water. You can actually see it growing on the side of the roads here in springtime. So at this time of the year, it generally isn't growing. But I have played around with the microclimate within my own garden. So I still have borage at this time of the year, even in the intense heat. But that's because I'm growing it in shaded areas in my garden so that I can regenerate it, you know. And I'm constantly, as soon as a plant dies, I constantly replant seeds, you know. So it's a sustainable circle all the time. So as the plant starts dying, I harvest the seeds and then I replant again. So that's how I do it. As I said, I try and find a new plant every year, but they're plants from all over the world. So one of the most popular ones for a lot of my Asian clients or the Asian restaurants that I service is the garlic flower, the purple garlic flower, which is actually a South African plant. It's called Tolbagia viocella, and it comes all the way from South Africa. It used to be called the sati garlic because that's what they used to put on their food back in the 1600s when they first were eating a lot of garlic in their dishes, because South Africa, of course, was part of the East India spice route from Spain all the way down through to the east, you know. So yeah, it depends very much on the palate or what kind of food the restaurant or the chef is looking to produce as to what their popular flowers are. So different restaurants have different things that they prefer, you know. And there's a bit more work in the edible leaves, because the edible leaves are not as easy to grow, especially in the climate here in Spain, because the soil is very difficult to dig. So I grow everything in raised beds. I have constructed raised beds, also because of my age, so that I don't have to bend so much.
I'm getting there too.
But
I'm
it's definitely definitely the way to farm, I think, you know, because you can control the kind of soil you've got in there. You can add to the soil. You can control the amount of water that's going in. There's a lot to be said for growing in raised beds. And then my husband, who's very handy, he's constructed like little worm tubes into the ground in my raised beds, where we can put some of our old produce into there, or the compost into there, or some of the worms from the worm farm into there.
Wow.
And then these holes in there, and then that can be led out into the rest of that raised bed. So we can control everything more carefully.
The nitrates naturally, as they would have decomposed anyway, normally.
Exactly.
You're kind of imitating nature, where it doesn't have to lay on top and get in your way. It's just, but still going in.
It's seeping. It's seeping through as it needs to. Yeah.
Amazing. I wanted to ask you, when you grow a plant and it dies and you grab the seeds, do you have to do anything to like replenish the soil, or do you rotate parts out? How do you repurpose that soil?
I tend to rotate. I mean, if you go back into the history of farming, they always say you should be planting nitrogen feeding plants like peas and beans. All the legumes are nitrogen feeding plants, and you should have at least four plots of land where you leaving one fallow once a year, one planted with nitrogen, and then you cultivating or having livestock on the other two, and then each year you rotate that. With the flowers, I don't do it as much, but that's because I'm constantly rotating all the time anyway.
Yeah.
And another thing that I do when I'm planting, I'm constantly using the theory of companion planting. So for an example, roses and garlic and onions, they all grow really well together because the one supports the other one.
Yeah.
And if you go online on Pinterest or whatever, you'll find companion planting sheets about what vegetables grow well together, what plants grow well together, what
not
plants not to plant together. So that's a whole nother science, you know.
I went to this really cool farm in Dominica. So not Dominican Republic, but Dominica. And it was, we were there on kind of like a mission ship, because they had just gotten flattened pretty much in Hurricane Maria in 2017. And so they're helping people, and it was just kind of still torn up. And this is probably 2019 I went there, still just a lot of people needed a lot of help. But this, there's called Free Up Farm. And this couple up there was doing this farming like I've never seen it before. And you might know, it was like a Japanese kind of seed ball guru. I think he kind of reinvented farming because he messed up his entire investment initially. And then he kind of repurposed everything. But it was the idea, the opposite of a monocrop. And it was, so what this Free Up Farm was it was kind of terraced, but kind of more like, I guess, dikes, for lack of a better word. And there'd be dead logs buried inside the dikes. And so they built everything so that the water would run in the appropriate way. So like everything in the farm got the right amount of water from the rainy season. It was
exactly genius.
It looks so cool. And it just looks so smart and clever. And I love the science behind it, instead of just like, oh, just whack some pesticides on it and let's just eat it.
And also by planting the logs into the ground, you're adding carbon back into the soil. And by adding carbon back into the soil, you're increasing the microbiome culture of all the little insects and everything that are living in the insects that live in the carbon. So there's another guy here in.
It was like as soon as the plants got big enough to reach into the, they had another energy source in that log that was buried in there.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Such a good idea. They also talked about,
and I think
it's called like disaster storage. And it was potatoes and cassava and all this shit that wouldn't wash away in a hurricane. You know, they had a really cool word for it. It was like, yeah, the food is stored underground. And we grew a lot of it for this reason, in case we need it in a disaster again. You would love this place.
So, I mean, in the olden days, they didn't have fridges. So they all had underground cellars where they stored all their fruit and vegetable. And I mean, it's something I've often thought about if I ever was to go back to a boat. I mean, if you bury your potatoes and carrots and stuff in clean sand, you can extend the shelf life of those for so much longer.
Like a pirate?
Because they're almost planted, but not quite planted, you know?
Yeah.
So it's quite interesting. If you look at all the old ways of doing things, of preserving food, there's so much knowledge in what they were doing back then, you know, that we've lost now. We just don't know that knowledge anymore.
Yeah, and they might be more sustainable, use less energy, be safer for us and more natural.
Absolutely.
And not crush that organism we're going to eat, you know?
Yeah, really nice. Exactly.
Yeah, it's, I love these conversations because they don't happen enough. It's just like, go to the supermarket, grab out of the refrigerator, put it in a bag, check out, put it back in a bag, bring it to your home, and that's it. Put it in the refrigerator, you eat it, but it doesn't have to
Chefs on the boats are more passionate about what they're putting on the plate than most of the crew. I mean, the rest of the crew are just trying to get through the day. I mean, we all work equally hard on a boat.
Yeah.
They don't really want to talk about food at the end of the day. And I think more of the top chefs on boats are really starting to understand that flavor and taste comes from how well the food is grown. And that's one of the things I love about Instagram, is because there are lots of growers like me out there. So I've had a couple of chefs this year ask me, oh, where are you? Can we come and visit you? Obviously, because of COVID, I haven't been able to have people come up.
Right.
But there are growers like me in Malta, in Greece. I mean, Jan, I don't know if you've ever heard of edible flowers in England. I mean, she's probably one of the world leaders in edible flowers and plants. And she's so inspirational to everyone, because her flowers were used for the last launch of the big James Bond movie and this kind of thing. So. Okay. You know, and that's inspired growers all over the world. In Australia and New Zealand, there are so many people growing for their local restaurants with unusual herbs and different kinds of garlics. And it's just incredible what's out there, you know?
It's a really good idea for a website, just to connect, it's kind of self-serving, because I would love to like just plug into a network and be like, who's around? Like, what story can I tell? What things can I make with what's around, rather than just
getting
a provisioner?
Exactly.
So, I mean, as all chefs do, we love the convenience of a provisioner, but it's worth it to get it local if you can tell a story, I think, and it just tastes better. and looks better and it's probably healthier. But that'd be a cool website if you linked up every like small, like kind of like high-end grower that was doing stuff for really nice restaurants and just had this access to this database of humanity and its ingenuity with fruit and veg.
Yeah. I know. And I think as people understand, it's not just about, because a lot of people have asked me, oh, will you send your flowers to Madrid or to Germany or whatever? And I said, well, again, it's against my ethos because I want to supply locally. And I think COVID has hit everyone, the restaurant and the catering businesses, incredibly hard all around the world.
Definitely.
So I think the whole idea of supporting one another is becoming more viable. And I've had a couple of chefs come to me and I've said, well, if you're going to Greece, I can give you the name of someone on Instagram that I follow. I know they do what I do. Here's their Instagram link, because you can see what they're doing and that they're producing the right kind of things, you know? I'll link in people who get to me about microgreens. Yes, I don't grow them, but I can tell them who on the island does grow them, you know? So go on Instagram. If there's someone that you're interested in and if you want to follow edible flowers and use them throughout the Med, go onto my Instagram, go to my followers and check out who I'm following, because I'm following all those kinds of people throughout the world, really. Getting inspiration from them, checking in with them, seeing what they're doing, being inspired what they're doing, you know, seeing new products that are coming out and researching and seeing if I can grow it here.
It's great. I can tell you're passionate about it. I love it.
I'm very passionate about it. My kids say, oh, Mom, please stop now.
Oh, it's incredible. That's so cool. Yeah, I really wish, you know, because I was here. We picked up a charter. Did we pick up here? No, we dropped off here. But we could have. Yeah, I would have loved to have gotten some of your stuff because I rotated out and Dean rotated in. He would have loved that, just to have stuff.
Dean actually picked up some stuff from me, I think it was a week and a half ago. Perfect. For the first time. Perfect. And it was really nice to meet up with him because I've been following him, obviously. I love what he does on his Instagram. Because I used to be a big diver as well. And having worked in environmental documentary, I've done documentaries on raggies and, you know, sharks and coral reefs and all of that kind of thing, which I love. I mean, that's my other passion. And it was so nice to actually meet someone who's been doing stuff like that. And I follow all his videos when he went to the Galapagos and all the rest. So it was really interesting to meet him. Yeah.
Nah, he's such a cool dude. I couldn't think of anybody like I'd rather rotate with. Like, he's just such a, we're so different yet, you know, pointed in the same direction anyway. Nah, he's a great dude. He really is. Talented chef and cool guy, funny, good sense of humor. Yeah, great dude.
I wish I'd had more time to chat to him, but it was an early morning pickup and off he went. Yeah. And it's also always great to get some feedback from the different chefs about what they think of my product and how well it's lasted, because that really gives a grower some inspiration. And Dean was amazing. He gave a shout out to me, which I really wasn't expecting. And I think my followers grew by like 100 followers just because of his shout out, you know.
Yeah,
it was really amazing. And I was meeting him on the dock for 10 minutes.
But I mean, he's going to be, as well as myself, the people that support you, because we appreciate you. And it's hard for us to find people like you, because I might not be back in Palma for 6 years or two.
And
to go around these places, and you're always hitting kind of new places, which is one of the best parts of the job. I'm not complaining at all, but you kind of don't know where to go. So it's always this.
Exactly.
Sometimes you don't have the time to find out, or you don't have the right contacts, whatever. So it's a good struggle though. It's really, I think the favorite part of my job for me is to look out a window and it's somewhere different every day. It's just this beautiful scenery. Yeah. And as you know, it's nice. It's a good place to have your office has a different view every day.
I mean, I was very lucky. I don't know if you know Mikael Swindles.
Yeah.
He's actually been a great help to my business, because he met me through my Muy Bueno Chef cookery school. Because they bought some of the produce from me for one of the cooking things that he did there. And that's how I got to know him. And then he's explored what produce I'm doing, and has always been calling me since then. And that's been going on for about 3 years now. And he's the one who's actually put my name out there. And that's who Dean got my name from. So because I asked Dean, so how do you know about me, you know? So he said, oh, no, from Mikhail. So it definitely is all word of mouth and helping support one another. And I really, really appreciate that kind of help. Thank you very much, guys.
Yeah. And we appreciate you, because other than that, it's stuff that's coming from Holland, which is great. And it lasts forever and it still has flavor, but it's not the same as right here, right now. Like, it's still warm from the sun. There's no comparison. So I think the Yacht Chef community can happily support and promote everything that you do. I think it's pretty amazing, because we don't have farmers. We just don't have that. And I really miss it. You know, my short time, what was it, 10 years as a restaurant chef. It's like, it's different now. It's just disconnected. Yeah.
No, I think it just is how life is. But if you learn to use all these new technologies that are out there, you can find stuff. And definitely since I started living here in Mallorca, I mean, the word organic was like, what's that, when I first arrived here? And now there's aisles in the supermarket with organic food, you know? Yeah. So it's really great to see that there is more development in that. More of the restaurants are even looking to buy more local. And it's not just the profit line all the time, because restaurants have to work on the profit line, but they are becoming more and more aware of what they're putting on their plates, you know? Yeah. And I think this is another thing I just wanted to add in there. I know organic is better than normal, but you have to understand that organic doesn't mean that it's not sprayed with some kind of pesticide. It's sprayed with a pesticide that has been approved within the organic list of pesticides. So there is a differentiation between not growing with anything and growing with organic, you know?
Yeah, I think that word is very vague around the world as well. The best I've heard of, and maybe you can comment on this too, is the French with their bio. Like, supposedly they're quite strict and actually aren't doing what they're supposed to do.
And the Jean-Martin Fortier, the Canadian guy who I was talking, he's French-Canadian, and he learned a lot of his methodology and what he's doing in his farm in Canada from the French system, from the ancient French ways of farming the land. So it's very interesting. If you're interested in that kind of stuff, you should definitely go on, look at his channel. Go onto Instagram. There's some Swedish guys up in Sweden. They have an Instagram called Berg's Fairy Tale Garden. And I mean, when I first looked at what they produce in this amazing garden, raised garden that they've got, and they've got all these different colored eggs from all the different kinds of chickens that you can have. Cool. So I've got my first leghorn chickens now. So I'm producing my first blue eggs. They're chickens that lay all different colored kinds of eggs, you know, like a whole range of, they look like they're painted eggs, but they're not. They're naturally produced. There's the just so ones. Much out there. It's so exciting.
I've gotten the blue ones before, but I thought they had to eat like blue feet or some shit like that. I was like, oh.
No. It's just the breed of chicken that it is. It's just the breed of chicken.
Because that's that Warner Brothers Foghorn Leghorn. You remember him? The big chicken from like the cartoons? Back in the day,
I remember I grew up in South Africa, so we were not getting a lot of that kind of stuff to watch.
Okay, all right.
South Africa got television when I was 16 only. You know, we didn't have television in South Africa. I think we were the last country in the world to get television, so I missed out on a lot of those kinds of cartoons and things.
You didn't miss much. You didn't miss much. It was just a weird connection to my youth. This cartoon character. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Leghorn, Leghorn. Well, I mean, this has been really nice talking to you. It's been pretty epic. And I look forward to keeping in touch with you and spreading the word as much as I can about if you're in Palma or maybe in Barcelona, and just to get some amazing edible flowers and edible leaves. And it's been really great having you on. Thanks for coming. It's been great.
Thank you very much, Brandon. It's been lovely to meet you as well.
Hang out for a little bit after, and we'll talk some more. But thank you, everyone. I hope you enjoyed that episode of Get the Fork Out, and we'll be back for more very soon. Thank you. We'll be right back.